Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Our guest now is somebody who's been described as one of the 500 most influential Muslims in the world. Now, there is a title, the grandiosity of which we've rarely had on Sunday nights. It's welcome to Susan Carland. Hello, Susan.
Thank you very much. Hello.
How does the crown sit?
It's a heavy burden. I was as surprised as anybody when I made that list, I have to say.
Susan, to many Australians, is also known as a regular panellist on shows like Q&A and others, and also the partner of probably Australia's most popular Muslim duo, Waleed Ali and Susan Carland. It's a double act that's hard to better anywhere in the country. Susan, it's so good of you to join us this evening.
Thank you so much.
You've been asked many times how you converted to Islam and why you converted to Islam. Mm-hmm. I'd like to start off talking about that, but with a slightly different twist. That is, you grew up in a society which was essentially Christian.
Yep.
Your background, you probably went to Sunday school as a kid, you can tell us about that. But at some point you decided that in assessing a life that was going to be meaningful, you decided to not go down the mainstream path of Christianity, and there are myriad varieties of Christianity you could have chosen, but into Islam. Now, before we talk about what's positive in Islam, what was it about Christianity you decided was inadequate?
It's a tricky one, because I don't ever want my becoming Muslim to be seen as some sort of negative rejection of Christianity, but I suppose in some ways it can only be understood in that way. But I guess I just want to say that I only had a very positive experience in Christianity. I have a huge amount of respect for the faith and the tradition. I think it was simply when I was 17, I just started to have a lot of questions that I didn't feel I was getting adequate answers for in the church about the nature of God.
Did you go to church?
Oh yes, I was very active in my church. I grew up in the Uniting Church and was there for the first 12 years of my life. Like you said, I went to Sunday school and every week, and I was christened and all those sort of things. And then when I was a teenager, of my own volition, my parents didn't go, but I started going to a local Baptist church, which was also a really positive experience for me. And I especially really enjoyed the music there. It was a very youth-orientated place. Really good people there. But it was, when I was about 17 that I just started to have questions about, specifically about God, that I felt I just wasn't getting answers that made sense to me within the church. And it was then that I started to wonder, well, why do I believe this at all? Is it because I think it's true, or is it just because this is what I've been raised to believe? And that's when I sort of went on a journey to find out what I actually believed for myself. And that's the beginning of this journey, and it ended up with me becoming Muslim.
What was the difficult cruncher for you about Christianity? Was it the Jesus is God stuff?
Yeah, the Trinity was something I really struggled to wrap my head around. You know, not from lack of trying. I was also baptized as a teenager. And I went to home group and cell group and all these sort of things to try to, and I read my Bible regularly, daily. My Bible is, the cover has literally fallen off my Bible from being read so often. But it just, I felt like the core issues for me weren't being adequately explained, and that's what pushed me elsewhere.
So it wasn't so much what Jesus said about ethics or the way we should live or that sort of thing. It was about the theology, the doctrinal stuff that was
absolutely
difficult for you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I really believe that all the prophets came with this. I mean, every leader in all the religious traditions, really, they all come with essentially the same message about ethics and living an ethical lifestyle and serving humanity. So the teachings of Jesus was never the issue. It, like you said, it was the explanation of who Jesus was in relation to God and that sort of thing, which, because it's such a fundamental part of Christianity, it felt like something I really needed to comprehend and believe for me to be able to stay within the faith.
Yes, the thing that most Jews and Muslims would say about Christianity is that this idea of God becoming incarnate creates all sorts of problems, not only for what you believe, but how you must relate to the world, because it creates all sorts of scientific, intellectual and other problems that Islam and Judaism don't have to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also for me as a woman, I felt an uneasy tension about God in male form and that sort of thing too, and then how, therefore, should I view men in general and women in general? So there was a lot of that sort of thing that was tied up for me.
If then for you the walk away from Christianity was one about theology and the way that theology got expressed in the world, or how you did it, other people would say, well, hang on, Islam's just got many of the same problems. They may be presented in different forms, but those problems, that the mix of sort of cultural accretions and religious truth, they're just as difficult in Islam as they are in Christianity or in any other of the major traditions. This is a constant battle in every religious tradition, surely.
Yeah, look, I take that. I think for me, the core belief structure in Islam was one that made a lot of sense to me, was very logical. The absolute idea of monotheism. There is one unique God that is the God of everybody. And the other fundamental things that you had to believe to be Muslim, I didn't have any logical struggle with. Now, absolutely, like any other religious tradition, there's passages in the Quran, the Muslim holy book, that at first reading and even second and third reading can be troubling and confronting and give you cause for pause, like in any other religious text. But the crux of the religion and the matters of belief made sense to me in a way that I didn't feel in Christianity. So the other issues, like things that might be contained within the Quran that may require further digging for me, were never deal breakers like the way I felt the Christian view of God was.
Susan, I mentioned a couple of your qualifications at the beginning of the program, but we also should say you're working on a PhD, you're a lecturer at university, and your particular interest is sociology and gender, and particularly women in Islam. Mm-hmm. Now, over recent years, there have been several prominent women in Islam visit Australia. One could think of one extreme of somebody like Urshad Manji, a sort of radical lesbian Muslim. On the other hand, Ayan Hirsi Ali, who says, I grew up Muslim, I have to reject Islam. Here's a range of experience about Islam and women, which is as diverse and widespread about as women about Christianity or any of the other faiths. What's your particular interest, and how do you regard women from those extremes? Where do you regard them as belonging to the tradition and having something to say that's still useful for the tradition?
Where I sort of exist within that and my research and myself as a woman and as a Muslim is, I'm looking at the way Muslim women living in the West, so specifically Australia and America, fight sexism from within their own traditions and communities from a pro-faith perspective. So I'm interested in women, Muslim women, who use their religion to fight to get the rights that they believe they deserve. And I'm interviewing theologians and activists and writers and bloggers. And the reason I think this is an important story is because from the advent of Islam, Muslim women have existed who have used their religion to stand up for their rights and to stand up to men, whether it be their husbands or the men in power or anybody else, and say, hey, you can't do that. You can't take that away from me. My religion protects this right for me, and I'm going to fight you for this. And yet that type of woman is so rarely heard about in the wider community. There's still this pervasive idea that Muslim women are these helpless victims that need to be rescued from their religion and often from themselves if they don't want to let go of the religion.
If we take the two women I mentioned, one of them writing polemically about Islam as somebody who still wants to claim Islam as their heritage, but saying, no, Islam has got to come to terms with a whole lot of things about modernity and it's just not doing it, and that's Urshad Manji. Let's talk about her and the sorts of attitudes that she brings to the discussion. She says, I can be a radical lesbian feminist and still be a Muslim.
Right. Well, I mean, I would never tell someone. If someone says that they're Muslim, then they are. It's as simple as that for me. So if she says she's a Muslim, then I believe her and I consider her a Muslim as well. You know, I don't think being a lesbian or being a feminist takes you outside of Islam. I mean, I'm not a lesbian, but I am a feminist. And I see no contradiction between Islam and feminism whatsoever. Now, I feel uneasy about some of the approaches and conclusions that Urshad Manji has reached in her critique of Islam. There are some that I vehemently disagree with. However, I would also say that critique is healthy. I would always want there to be a landscape within our religious tradition where we can debate these ideas furiously. And I would much rather that happen than there be no opportunity for that debate to be taking place at all.
Yeah, she's had a role in opening doors, even if the noise of them slamming has been quite aggressive and loud at some points.
Mm-hmm.
She has been willing to take on what many would regard as elements of the tradition that should be honoured and said no. Mm. They're cultural, they're not doctrinal. Mm. Now, Christianity has a long tradition that, because of the way Christianity has been historically structured, that is through denominations which preserve traditions, has enabled intellectual argument to take place and sort of decisions to be made, albeit they take a long time, they still get made and worked through. Islam doesn't quite operate that way. So how do you begin a discussion in Islam about these issues, which takes you to a conclusion?
Definitely the Muslim community is different to the Christian one in that regard, and especially because, you know, we don't have this idea of ordination. So there is no sort of recognised leadership in that regard, and we also don't have an idea of excommunication either. I think what's good, though, to keep in mind is that these debates have always taken place in Islamic scholarship. You know, scholars have been put to death because of the things that they have suggested right through Islam. And the most our most esteemed scholars have argued very aggressively with each other as well on big things and little things. There has always been this ocean of scholarly debate in Islam. So that in and of itself isn't a problem. But like you said, I don't think there are actually very few things that Muslim scholars will come to a point and say everybody agrees on this, that this is the correct opinion. There are some things we certainly don't disagree on, like the oneness of God, and that if you're a healthy, sane adult Muslim, you should pray five times a day and those sort of things. But pretty much every other issue you could come up with, there has been some scholarly debate on it. So debate is good and healthy. And I think for any religion to survive, the conversation keeps needing to be had over and over and over again. The important thing, though, I think, is that it's had by people who are truly qualified and understand the tradition well enough not to do more damage to the discussion and the outcome than good. Now, I recognise that saying that can, of course, can lead to an elitist sort of level discussion where only the very highest of people can discuss issues that affect everybody. But I guess the point I'm trying to make with that in relation to Irshad Manji is I felt that when I read her book, there were some very elementary mistakes that had been made or misunderstandings of things that I felt were unfortunate, because I know how many non-Muslims, for example, read her book and felt very excited by it. And I thought, you're not really being given the full story here. But like I said, even though I disagreed with a lot of what she said, I would definitely fight for her right to say it and for the conversation to be had. And the reality is, if we didn't have problems in the community, there would be no book for her to write. So we need to accept that a lot of the criticisms that she made were valid as well.
Let's then move to the other prominent ex-Muslim feminist who's been to Australia several times in the last few years, and that's Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She's somebody who's grown up in a very primitive Islamic culture, moved into the West, had the restraints of that culture imposed upon her, even as she's tried to move away from it and has suffered for it. She's somebody who says, the only way I can deal with this is to reject it completely and reject the whole idea of not only the tradition, but the whole idea of God with it. These things are ultimately destructive of the human person. How do you come to terms with the sorts of experience she's had in her life?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think any of us should deny that she had a really difficult childhood, and her growing up, she experienced some horrible things in the name of her religion. And, you know, none of us should be trying to defend that at all. And I can understand, if having such an awful upbringing has led her to feel pretty negatively towards the religion she sees as responsible in that. However, of course, I really reject the conclusion that she's come to, that ultimately Islam is inherently wrong and inherently problematic, and that Muslims are either bad people, and if they're good people, it's because they don't really understand their religion properly. And I think what's unfortunate about Ayaan Hirsi Ali's situation is that her unique situation is somehow being viewed as sort of the norm for many Muslim women around the world.
Well, a lot of people would say it's normative for an awful lot of them.
Well, I'm not sure if that's the case or not. I mean, you know, like I said, I don't think we should deny that that sort of thing happens, but I don't think we should be assuming that Ayaan Hirsi Ali speaks for all African Muslim women or all Somali Muslim women or anything like that, I think her situation is unique, and the fact that even her sisters don't view their upbringing the same way she did shows that it's not a blanket experience.
She does go on, though, to make some generalisations out of her situation, generalisations which would go to issues that you're dealing with about the inherent status of women within the tradition, and it's so pervasive that it's problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, again, I really disagree with that. And, you know, she has the right to her own opinion, but I think it's unfortunate. I think many of the conclusions she's drawn are just wrong. There's no other way that I can put it. I think she applies a terrible selectivity to her understanding of things. And like I said, I think her upbringing explains much of why she feels so angry towards her religion, but that doesn't mean that that's an objective truth. All I can say is that not only do I disagree with her, but so do a lot of sincerely practicing Muslim men and women. And it's not because we have Stockholm syndrome, or that we don't understand our religious tradition properly, or that we're just whitewashing things. I mean, even if I was trying to cover up in my own mind the cruel reality, I, as a protective mother of a daughter, would never, ever want to bring her into something that I thought was inherently dangerous and sexist towards her.
Let's talk about one of the issues that everybody talks about, and they ask you about it constantly because you wear it. You wear the veil. Now, mm-hmm. The veil is alternately seen as a sign of liberation, that is, a woman can be independent, freed of her sexual identity in general public, or, on the other hand, is a repressed individual. Now, this is the way the discussion tends to be polarised. Mm-hmm. You're somebody who chooses to wear the veil. Why? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, like, for most women who choose to wear it as opposed to having it forced on them externally, and, you know, there are certainly women that do have that happen. For all women who choose to wear it generally, it's done as an act of worship to God. That's the one unifying thing for all of us. You know, as Muslims, everything we do can be an act of worship to God. And so for me, the way I dress is also part of that.
So it's a spiritual discipline.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, of course, there are other layers on top of that. You know, I can see good feminist arguments for wearing it. I can understand the political reasons that some women wear it, especially overseas in countries like in Egypt and Iran. They used it as a political statement against the government. You know, if I've got a friend who simply wears it, you know, she sort of said, just in my culture, that's just what we all do. I never really thought about why I wore it until I came to Australia and people started to ask me. And then I realised, well, actually, this might religion. It's not, you know, it's not just because that's what we do in my village. So there's a lot of other reasons that are layered on top of that. But I think the single unifying reason, like I said, for women who choose to wear it is that it's an act of worship to God.
But it's not essential. It's not an essential doctrine of the faith, as it were.
Well, people disagree about that. Like I said before, pretty much everything Muslim scholars will disagree about, and this is one thing. Majority of scholars agree that a woman should cover her hair, although there are some modern scholars that say that's not the case. But then there's much greater disagreement about whether should a woman cover her face and that sort of thing. And throughout time, scholars have understood it differently and in different countries and all those sort of things.
Christianity was like that not so long ago. I mean, you've only got to go back 40 years, and people recall the first waves of Italian and Greek migrants that came to Australia sort of half a century ago. The women were, particularly widows, were in black with shawls and veils. And if you go back before that, Catholic women, not half a century ago, would cover their heads in church because that was the thing that one had to do. Theologians, scholars, others have moved on and said, look, ultimately, yes, in certain cultural conditions, that is considered normative practice for the faith, but we can conceive it of a time when it wouldn't be. So say if your kids grew up in sort of, you know, easy, relaxed, laid-back Australia, good Muslims just said, oh, no, look, I'm not going to wear the veil. And that doesn't alter the depth of my sincerity or commitment to the faith. Would that disturb you?
No, not at all. I mean, in the end, all my children's lives have to be one of integrity for themselves. I would never want them to be Muslim or practice any of the Muslim practices to make me happy. It's got to be something that is right for them, and it has to be an expression for them. Otherwise, I'm just raising hypocrites. And I could totally understand why my daughter might come to me and say, either I don't believe it's compulsory and I'm not going to wear it for that reason, or she might say, look, I think it's something that I should do, but it's just too hard in Australia. In the end, it's their own lives, and I support them and making their own spiritual choices, especially I think myself, who, you know, really went against what my family believed and the way they raised me, to come to my own spiritual journey and come to my own decisions. So I really support that for my own children. As long as my kids grow up with a strong sense of themselves and a strong sense of respecting their bodies, whatever manifestation that takes, that has to be their own.
What about the other, and this is the much hackneyed question I'm sure you get all the time, about the full face? Is there a civil liberties or a civil rights argument about the veil and the way it's been used? It's become a talking point overseas. It's become a talking point in Australia, particularly in New South Wales, where there was a case of a traffic infringement that blew up into other things because of the use of the face covering. How do the arguments bear here? The civil rights argument is, look, if as a participant in a democratic society, the one thing you need to be able to be is identifiable. And the moment you give people the privilege of anonymity, all sorts of abuses can creep into the system. Do you buy into that argument?
Well, I think it's a problematic argument to bring with women who cover their faces, because the reality is they always are uncovering their faces for identification purposes. So when they go to get a passport or when they fly, they have to uncover their faces. When they have their license photos taken, and if the police ask them to remove their veil, they do have to uncover their faces. So they, when they're being asked to ID themselves by, you know, appropriate law enforcement agencies, they're already doing that. And in terms of, you know, going into the bank or the post office or that sort of thing, you know, a couple of years ago, it was when Kevin Rudd was still Prime Minister, and this burqa thing flared up once again. And it was interesting because Kevin Rudd said, you know, none of the security agencies in Australia have told me that women covering their faces is a security issue. So ASIO is not asking for me to introduce a law. AFP is not asking for this to happen. Australia Post and National Australia Bank both issued statements saying, we're happy to have Muslim women who cover their faces as customers. We don't have a problem with it. So if all of these organisations and security enforcement agencies are saying, this isn't an issue for us at the moment, we're not having any security threats with this, I'm wondering why this argument is still being bandied around.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guest is Susan Carland, well-known Islamic scholar, activist in Australia, and a media personality of some note, particularly with the Muslim comedy program of a few years ago. That was a very interesting little exercise.
That's a very polite way to put it.
Let's show that Muslims are as willing to be sent up as everyone else in Australia. One of the things that does get often sent up in Islam, as it does in Christianity, is what we call fundamentalism. That is, those people in Christianity gets caricatured as those who believe in creationism and, you know, literal seven-day creationism, and they tend to get bashed. Well, sometimes one may say they deserve it, particularly the way in some sections of the United States they behave. How is that wrestled with in Islam? That is, how do you move from the fundamentalist and literalist to the more refined within communities? And we've already alluded to the fact that Islam doesn't work like Christianity in this. So is it just a matter of finding the people who agree with you and talking to them?
I think, to be honest, I think that's human nature, isn't it? We sort of surround ourselves with the people that agree with everything we say, and, you know, we go to the mosque where we like the message that's being taught and that sort of thing. So I think that's just kind of what we do. You know, we find people who express the religion and teach it in the way that we like, and they're the ones that we gravitate towards.
Because there are many in Islam, just as there are in Christianity, who would say, look, what the book says, the book says, and you cannot move away from that. Now, of course, that ignores the fact that, as you've already indicated, every time you read the book, you're reading it through culturally determined eyes. But this idea in Islam that the book is what the book is, and more than that, it is what it is in Arabic, does that in some way confine the way scholarship works and the way it must work? That is, can you get a liberal tradition emerging out of that?
Absolutely, I think you can, and we have. It already exists, and it's existed for quite a while. I think the idea that what the book says is what the book says and that's it is just such a misunderstanding. And especially, you know, when I look at it in the Islamic tradition, there's a really famous story that I think explains this really well, that there was a man called Ali who was the fourth caliph after the Prophet Muhammad died, and the ruler before him had been murdered by some other Muslims, and the Muslims that lived at that time were angry that Ali wasn't judging the way they thought he should, which was that they believed Ali should go and kill the murderers. And they said, it's in the Quran, you have to do what the Quran says. And so Ali, the leader, picked up the Quran and said, okay, let's let the Quran decide. And they said, yes, we agree. So Ali put the Quran, the book, on the table and said, there's the Quran, now decide. Speak Quran, tell us what to do. And of course, the point he was trying to make is every single one of us who reads any book, but especially a religious text, we are going to read it differently. The act of reading the book is an interpretation, and we are all going to interpret it differently. There is no objective reading of the Quran. And so what that means is everybody comes to it with their own lenses, not just their cultural, but their age, their gender. We all come with different lenses in the way we interpret it. And that's why you do have your very black and white, like you said, fundamentalist type, right down to the most progressive, liberal interpretations. And all of them genuinely believe that they are reading the Quran the way it should be read and reading it in a holistic way and implementing what God would want them to implement.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio, our guest Susan Carland. Susan, let's move away from the theology and begin to talk about life as a Muslim in Australia today. You're bringing kids up in a largely secularised culture. On this front, you'd probably share many of the apprehensions that Christians, Jews, Hindus, members of other faith communities do, that there's a certain lack of coherence in a sort of atomised society that tends to be getting worse. We've seen the recent jeremiads by various commentators on what's happening in the UK, on the global financial crisis, many of them saying, look, this comes down to a lack of coherent moral formation in society. How do you respond to those sorts of issues? Because that must be something of what drives you as a parent to say religion must be important for my family and my kids in particular in growing into this world.
I don't know. I guess in the end, all I can do is try to be the best parent I can for my children and raise them with the, like any parent, we raise our kids with the values that we think are important. You know, I look around Australia and I don't believe that we're on the brink of moral collapse at all. If you know, if you want to summarize Islam down to one simple idea, it's love God and serve God and love humanity and serve humanity. That's it. That's
sounds
a religion.
Sounds like something like Jesus said at once.
Yeah, and too, probably all the religious traditions really, when you think about it, that's pretty much what we all teach. But the point of that is to make my kids realize, you know, if you really believe in God and love God, then you've got to work for society. That's what you have to do. You've got to take the focus off yourself. And it's always about doing what you can in the smallest way to helping someone because they're carrying something heavy too. You know, my daughter at the moment for Ramadan, she's trying to raise money for Somalia. And she's really excited. I think she's raised $300 or something like that. And I'm really wanting to encourage her because I want her to get this idea. It's not all about you. You have to constantly think, what can I do today to try to improve things for other people? This idea of civic responsibility and service, just not just in our own small community, but globally.
That idea of civic responsibility gets expressed in various ways in Islam. You've articulated it very clearly in a way which you could work on a multi-faith platform. You could cooperate with Christians and Jews. You have others who would say, no, the only way this can ultimately be exercised is through the ummah, through the entire nation being converted to Islam and it becoming part of the renewed caliphate. Because it is a sort of modern interpretation of Islam, but it's a modern interpretation that reaches back to almost an idea realized Islam.
I mean, I don't agree with it. And I just don't think this idea that Islam and Muslims can only flourish in a society where they are the rulers, that is the ultimate endpoint. I just don't agree with that. And I don't think it's the goal that we all necessarily need to be working towards. And I don't think it's stipulated specifically like that anywhere. I think the goal is, like I said, love God, serve humanity. And if that means that you are the one Muslim in your entire country of millions, then so be it. And the reality is, you know, when I look around the world and I see a lot of the countries run by Muslim rulers, I am so grateful to God that I live here in a country where I can practice my religion really freely, unlike in a way that I would not be able to in Muslim majority countries. So this idea that, okay, we live here as Muslims, but, you know, we all know that eventually what we really want to do is take over and have everyone be Muslim. I just don't agree with that, and I don't think that's what my religion teaches either.
What ultimately for you is the great benefit of Islam that recommends it to the world?
It's logical, spiritual cohesion. I really like the fact that it fulfilled me spiritually, but it also felt very logical. It made sense. I didn't feel that I had to leave my brain at the door. So I felt like in that sense it was a holistic package for me. And so obviously that's how I would explain it to other people as well. But, you know, in the end I really understand that everyone will find their answers in different places. And I don't believe everyone has to be Muslim to live a happy, healthy life or be great people. I think people need to live a life of integrity. And if everybody does that, whether they're Muslim or not, that would be my wish for them.
There's something in the way Islam too has recovered in contemporary society, something that Christianity also once had, and that's this notion of spiritual discipline. The idea that certain disciplines do actually play a benefit. That is, you step outside of the way the world wants you to order your life and order it according to another principle. And Islam brings that in a very concrete way every day into one's life.
Yeah, absolutely. I help run a convert support group for people who've become Muslim or thinking about becoming Muslim. And one of the things I always teach them is that Islam will teach you discipline. If you think you're not disciplined, it will teach you spiritual discipline and discipline of yourself. And I think that's a really good thing, especially in our society now of instant gratification and me. And if I want something, I get it now. I don't even have to wait. You know, now even if I want a book, I get it instantly on my Kindle. I don't even have to wait to get a book. It teaches you to slow down and think about other people and restrain yourselves, and there's a goodness in that.
Susan Carlin, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
Thanks for having me.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.